why don't we get started with the Finance and Administration Committee meeting. Before we begin our formal meeting, I'd like to ask Mr. Dougherty to give us today's safety contact.
Thank you, Mr. Acosta, members of the board. Just real quick on the emergency exits, if the fire alarm would go off, I'd ask that you exit either through one of the doors, either in front of me or behind me, and meet across the street in front of the building museum at the nut and bolt structure. Our safety contact this morning is on Halloween safety tips, which certainly can be applied at any other time. And we'd like to ask that you instruct older children to take friends or a parent when trick-or-treating. Make sure that a trusted adult or older child or you accompany your younger children when trick-or-treating. Accompany or make sure a trusted adult accompanies your younger children to the door of every home they approach. Teach your children to only enter homes with your prior permission and only approach homes that are well lit inside and outside. Teach your children to never approach a vehicle unless they are accompanied by you, even if it appears that no one is inside. Make sure children wear reflective clothing and carry a flashlight or a glow stick when traveling during the evening hours. Make sure your children are able to see and breathe properly and easily when using facial masks, and these masks should be flame resistant. Teach your children to always stay in well-lit areas, never take shortcuts or paths that are not lit, stay away from isolated areas. Teach your children to stay alert for any suspicious activity, something that's unusual to them, and notify you or police if they see anything. And teach your children, if anyone tries to grab them, to draw attention to themselves and loudly yell, "This person is trying to take me," or "This person is not my parent," or anything, and, you know, to try and get away. And then consider organizing or attending parties at home or in schools in your communities. And then also, as children do have cell phones today, it might be nice if they had a pre-programmed number, if you're not with them, to contact you, and then to always protect our children. And please have a safe day. Thank you, Mr. Acosta.
Thank you, Mr. Dougherty. Before you is an agenda for today's committee meeting. I'd like to just say that we have three items on this agenda, two are action items. One is to approve an amendment to the FY12 budget to accept a federal security grant. The next is to approve special fares and parking fees for the 2013 presidential inauguration. Also, we have a progress report from staff. This does kick off our budget season. They will be giving us a status report on the revenue assumptions that they'll be using to develop the FY14 budget. Also, I'd like to say I'd like to keep this committee meeting on schedule. We have both the Safety Committee and the Customer Service Committee right after this, and there's some very important items on that agenda. So I do intend to end this meeting by 10:30. With that, are there any other questions regarding today's agenda? I know Mr. Bolger had a question that I'll save for the end of the meeting that he'd like to raise with all of us. Next up is the approval of the minutes. They are before you. Do I hear a motion to accept the minutes? Mr. Downey moves.
Second.
Second by Mr. Bolger. All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Next up on our agenda, I will say that you do have a written presentation, a report in front of you regarding this, and I think this is a fairly self-explanatory item. We've seen a similar version of this in the past. So I would say we should forego the staff presentation. I'd just like to open it up to questions from you that you might have of the staff regarding this matter. Again, this is to amend the FY13 budget for FY12 to receive federal security grants. Are there any questions? Mr. Downey.
Just on the slide that shows the spread of the money, I'm wondering why it's shaped the way it is with a big lump of money in 14.
Okay, I'll respond to that, sir. The reason the amount is high in FY14 is the period of performance for the grant starts September 30th, 12, and extends through September 30th, 2014, due to the federal fiscal year. And that already skews the distribution of the most labor costs in FY14. And so some of the things were extended. We requested extensions for certain things, knowing that we could not completely take care of those in 13.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions regarding this item? Ms. Porter.
Question, is any of this funding being used to support the random bag inspection program?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? If not, I'd entertain a motion to approve this item.
Motion to ratify the acceptance of the grant and amend the budget.
Okay. We have moved and second. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
The matter?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. So that'll be noted on the record. All right. The motion passes. Next up on the agenda is the approval for special service and fairs for 2013 Inauguration Day. As you know, staff has been working on preparations for the inauguration. There are two elements to this. Obviously, today we are going to cover the issues of fairs. And also, there's also a number of issues related to service planning, the type of service that we'll be offering to our customers come Inauguration Day. Today's agenda focuses strictly on the fairs issue. And I understand that the service planning issues will be brought to the Customer Service Committee come December when they have met with the various jurisdictions to discuss kind of what their plans are and how we can improve our service or provide service to those with respect to the inauguration. So today I'd like to keep our the issues focused to the matter at hand. And with that, I'd like to ask Ms. Bowersox to begin the staff presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Acosta, and good morning, everyone. Good morning. The general manager has asked me to chair an internal working group. It's a multi-departmental working group that is brought together for the purposes of planning the inaugural events and the travel to support it. Our internal planning efforts and those with sister agencies, I would tell you, are very preliminary. I expect to return to the board in December, as Mr. Acosta indicated, after the Presidential Inaugural Committee has convened to determine the final schedule and slate of activities, at which point we'll be able to nail down details of our service plan. However, in order to prepare in advance for special fairs and services, we're seeking the board's approval today on a couple of matters which, to the extent possible, do mimic what WMATA did for the last inauguration in 2009. As you know, that was an historic day when Metro served record-breaking crowds. We carried about 1.5 million riders, roughly 1.2 million of them on rail to President Obama's inauguration. In 2013, the public swearing-in and parade is scheduled for Monday, January 21st, which is Martin Luther King Day, and crowds are estimated to be substantially lower than in 2009, and those preliminary figures range from 500 to 800,000 attendees. But again, even our sister law, the law enforcement agencies and the sister DDOTs that we have been working with are indicating that those numbers may change. Work with the Presidential Inaugural Committee begins in November after the election. Our current planning process is coordinated with the Virginia DOT, Maryland DOT, and the district's Department of Transportation, as well as Homeland Security, the Secret Service, the Park Service, and multiple jurisdictional law enforcement agencies. With respect to service, we expect on Monday, January 21st, to run an extended service from 4 a.m. to 2 a.m., instead of what would be typically 5 a.m. to midnight. We will determine other day service plans dependent upon events, again, returning to the board in December with that. We do anticipate peak levels of service throughout the day on rail. And to be more specific about that, we don't mean until closing time, but just as we did in 2009, depending upon events, probably until 9 or 9:30 at night. Also, we'll provide weekday service on our bus routes. There would be no Rush Plus trains on that Monday and no track work throughout the inaugural weekend to facilitate the flow of travel. Rail restrooms would be closed the entire weekend as we did in 2009. However, we have, again, ordered portable toilets throughout the system, particularly in the outlying areas, to help the customers. We will not be permitting bikes on trains that weekend in order to accommodate many visitors. And we will also be offering special inaugural alerts, which will update everyone who is interested in the service on operations as we go through the weekend. And that will provide real-time information for our customers, our stakeholders, and our event planning partners. With respect to fair policy, we are recommending two products for January 21st. The first is a Smart Trip commemorative card. It's a $15 product with a one-day pass preloaded on it at the currently available rail pass rate of $14. That gives you a $1 discount after the $2 usual Smart Trip fee post-rebate. That would be sold in advance to customers through sales offices and on the Internet. The product will also be good as a flash pass for unlimited travel on bus that day, Monday, January 21st. It will not be sold in fare card machines, but again, we will market it aggressively and sell it in advance. The reason for doing that, of course, is to give the customers the most convenient method for traveling through the system, and also because Smart Trip cards allows you to travel through the gates and not queue up at our fare machines, and so it allows us to reduce queuing and crowding, and that does help us in terms of safety of all of our customers, visitors, and regular commuters alike. The paper fare card product will also bear a commemorative photo of the successful presidential candidate, offering a one-day pass, $14, good on rail only. And that fare product will be available through hand sales, but also through fare machines in stations, and it will be pre-sold as well as the Smart Trip card. With respect to parking, we have proposed to charge a normal weekday parking fee for Monday, January 21st. I would point out that unlike 2009, that fee would be collected upon exit. For those of you who were here, you may recall that the parking fee was charged upon entry in 2009. It did have some adverse consequences relative to traffic backups, and local law enforcement had to assist with traffic mitigation. And while we expect to have some of that problem, we hope to reduce it by charging upon exit using our new Fairgate technology to meter the traffic. As all lots are now automated, there will be both Smart Trip and credit card options for parkers on our system. The new technology allows us to both raise and lower the gates remotely and to monitor all parking lots from a central location. The gates would be lowered around the noontime hour, and lot full signs would be displayed in a timely manner. We do anticipate more parking demand than we have supply on that day. We'll be coordinating with the jurisdictions and the DOTs to provide updates and alternate suggestions for travelers once our lots are full. In terms of next steps, obviously the planning process continues. I also want to let the board know that we do have special inaugural account codes that we're using to track our expenses associated with the events, and we have already begun the process for seeking reimbursement through multiple federal funders, including UASI, but that will come with more time as we get closer to the event. Those opportunities will become better known to us, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bowersox. Again, this proposal basically, with a few exceptions, mimics the framework that we used for the 2009 inauguration in terms of fares and the general service planning that we had done at that time. I would like to open up to the floor, Ms. Callen and then Mr. Bolger.
Yeah. The fees we're proposing this year, is it an increase from 2009?
My understanding is that the $14 rail pass that we're offering on the Smart Trip card didn't exist in our fare structure in 2009, so it's a different product. The paper card fare would be the regular peak fare if you chose not to buy the special pass, and that would also represent something different than they had in 2009 because our fares have changed since 2009.
I guess my question is, if I purchased one last year and I purchased one this year, will I pay a different price than I did last year, the last time?
Yes.
And how much? That's what I'm trying to get a sense of.
This is from memory, but we're talking about the one-day pass. And I think the one-day pass in 2009 was $10 that we charged for that. And Carol, keeps shaking her head. Thank you. And so this now would be $14. The extra value, though, as Lynn indicated, would be that you're able to get a Smart Trip card at a lower price than you had from the prior year, which is a good value. And you can use that Smart Trip card for your future transportation. So there's still a value associated with it.
Thank you.
Mr. Bolter?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, Mr. Chairman, if we could get an explanation on page 16 of 57. I'll take a second. Above the timeline bullet format, Lynn, we will seek reimbursement from the Presidential Inaugural Committee to cover additional hours of service. However, the Presidential Inaugural Committee declined the reimbursement request after the events that were held in 2013. Could you just walk us through how that all works and how the Inaugural Committee reimburses or doesn't reimburse for expenses?
And I'll address it if Lynn would allow me, because I know Lynn wasn't here. We actually, and I was, so we approached the PIC, the Presidential Committee. As you know, they get started, you know, at that time when they know that candidate, December. And it just wasn't it was an expectation that they expected that the service was provided by Metro, and there was no, you know, expectation that the committee would reimburse that. And so we tried several times to meet with them, and we did, but it was not successful, obviously. We did try to then get reimbursement from other avenues, as you know, and may have been somewhat successful in that. But because of that, we will still attempt that, and I know Lynn is moving in that direction. And we also have some security grants, which the chief was indicating here, which are eligible for covering expenses associated with events like that, because there are security issues associated with that. So that actually helps us quite a bit.
Can we get Living Social maybe to cover these costs? Rich, whoever wins the election will then become like the learners, in my mind, and we need to get somebody to step up.
Any other questions for staff?
Mr. Costa.
Is the signs.
Sorry. So for our regular riders, these passes are neither here nor there, and the paper media is neither here nor there. They can use their regular Smart Trip card. And the only difference our regular riders would experience is that it's a holiday,
that's right,
but they're going to pay peak fares. And if somebody has, let me just ask this other question. People come and go from Washington all the time. I've got a stack of old paper fare media sitting on my dresser at home. I hand them out to my guests. They go and use it. It's going to cost them the fare plus the dollar for using the paper fare media?
I think so, Carol. I'm just confirming with you that the fare machines would have no way to distinguish the old paper fare media from new paper fare media, so the $1 fee for using paper fare media would apply, right? If they came from another town with the paper fare and uploaded it, that's my understanding,
okay.
Yes.
So really for guests, it's best to say go ahead and get the commemorative because well, it's actually probably not cheaper for interior. If you're at a hotel in Crystal City, it is the $14 pass, and we had this whole discussion. When we created the $14 pass, for those of us in the inner jurisdictions, it may or may not be the cheapest thing to do to get the one-day pass. And I'm particularly thinking, you know, we had lots of families in 2009, and at $14 a pop, if you're staying in Crystal City, it's probably cheaper for you to take a cab. So I always feel compelled to say that so that we're all clear, but that we also all know if we're using up that old fare media and we're not, there's a dollar extra charge for that on rail, and you can't use it on the bus, so just, it's so on rail. So just so we're all clear about that.
It's meant to have options, and so if you have a real long trip And I think we had done some analysis back in the day when we were doing the passes.
Where Mort lives, it's a good deal.
Right. And Mort, we took Mort's family and we sort of, you know, figured out where he was going. And it was a really long trip. It made a lot of sense to do that, the Smart Trip card, right, only because it was long distance. But you're right. If it's,
if you're in the inner jurisdictions,
right,
it's really not.
But as the board knows, but I'll take this opportunity with my marketing message to say that it's not only a price issue, it hopefully is also a convenience issue, and we want to encourage ridership on Metro versus a cab because of the crowding and because of the street closures and the zones that will be off limits to cars. And so really we'll suggest Metro, even if that means an extra dollar or two to those customers.
Regina reminded me, she is actually working very closely with the PIC, Will, with the PIC and the COG. And so we have Regina Sullivan. We didn't have her in 2009, so I'm hoping that she can actually make it a little bit more inroad in that, right, in trying to get some reimbursements from the PIC. So I just wanted to make that.
Okay. Mr. Downing?
Be sure I understand. This new commemorative Smart Trip card can be reloaded and used?
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions for staff? Ms. Bowser?
So, Sarah, when you're not going to order both, there's enough time to. I'm serious. I mean.
No, we have enough time.
Okay.
With the order will be placed after the election.
Okay.
Well, we might be able to sell them on eBay.
Are there any other questions for staff? Thank you, Ms. Bowersox, for the great presentation. I would entertain a motion to accept the resolution.
Motion to.
Mr. Downey and Mr. Boulder, seconds. Any other discussion regarding this matter? Okay, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, the matter is approved. Thank you. Next up is a informational item. As I noted earlier, we are now in the process of beginning our FY14 budget process. And we're going to take the next few months to get some progress reports regarding a number of different items before the general manager's budget is brought to the board in January. So we're going to start today with a progress report on revenue assumptions that are going to be used to build the FY14 budget. And also looking at some of the risks, some of the external risks, including sequestration, that might affect our budget outlook. As a reminder, we will also be hearing presentations over the coming months on expenses and the capital budget before the January presentation by the January presentation of the general manager's budget to the full board. So we're going to see pieces of it right now. Hopefully you'll get a better understanding, the public will get a better understanding of what is going into the budget and kind of the external forces that may shape it. But we'll have another bite at the apple come early next year as we go through the formal budget process. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Kissel, who will make her presentation.
Great, thanks. And Mr. Costa is right. This is really just a peek at, you know, the building blocks. It's really a process, as you know. You've all been through that. So I'm going to try to just provide the overview of where we are in the development of the planning and in the multi-year budget, and then provide the revenue picture, highlight a few key areas on, as Mr. Acosta indicated, that will impact the revenue picture. This is by no means the our revenue forecast. It's really just the start of what that looks like, okay? So, and I have here, I'll go through a couple of discussion points, and then I want to introduce Mark Schofield, who is our new senior economic advisor, who's done a lot of work on the revenue model. As you remember, last year we upgraded it, and he'll take you through some of the economic look and picture of what we're doing. So the building blocks, as you know, the revenue is first. And so, as Mr. Acosta indicated, you'll have the expense picture, November and December. We'll go into detail on that. And then you'll get a peek to it, jurisdictional contributions, you know, what that will look like. And then there's two things that are going to happen during that process, if you will, and they're happening actually currently. We're working with the ELT to develop efficiencies, initiatives wish list, if you like, of what, you know, we could do, what could move the needle on performance and customer service. We have about 160 of them, and actually we're in process of reviewing them with the general manager. He's tasked us with getting more efficiencies on that list versus just wish list items. So that will be forthcoming as we move forward. And the other piece of that will be there will be some policy decisions that we will bring forward to you potentially. And some of the ones that I'm thinking about here are potentially we have a new Metro Access business model. And you know that we'll be awarding a contract in the January timeframe. That may or may not have a policy, a decision associated with it, but it's something we have to look at. Fatigue management, I know that we're coming to you, and Dave's group is coming to you with fatigue management assessments with Jim Daugherty. And so that could have a policy impact that will impact the building blocks of how we look at our budget. So those we'll bring back to the board in the time frame and then have a January budget, you know, ready for you to look at. So I wanted to take you through just as a baseline, and I won't go through this in detail, but in some chatting with some of the committee members, the thought was, well, you know, Metro doesn't is not fully cost recovered. And we wanted to give you a picture of really each line of business, bus, rail, and Metro Access, what it really cost to provide the service and how much revenue we collect. And we just took a picture of what of the budget is now in FY13. And as you can see here, it costs, we actually take in revenue on the bus side, passenger revenue, about $140 million, and then we load in advertising revenue associated with that. But at the end of the day, it costs us about $500 million estimated to run our bus operations region-wide. And so the cost recovery on that, and it's a revenue number divided by the expense number, is 27%. So on, you go to rail, and rail, we probably have one of the highest recoveries, I think, in the nation on rail, and that's about 79%. And then if you look at access, it's lower than that. So at the end of the day, when you look at our total budget of $1.6 billion, $874 million really covers 55% of the cost to run our system. And so that's significant because there's, as you know, there's only three areas that we can go to try to balance a budget. There's revenue, and there's investment that you'd make, you know, on the jurisdiction side, and then there's cost and efficiencies and productivity. And we're actually, in this budget process, planning process, in the multi-year, we're attacking all three. And so that's actually a good thing. So another reminder on the subsidy allocations. These formula allocations do not change. They have been around since inception of Metro, and it's just a little reminder. What will change are the elements of how they're calculated. And as you all know, we're using the new census numbers, 2010 census numbers, that will drive some of the weighted change on population and on that will drive, obviously, some changes in the subsidy. And as you can see here, it's obvious that because we have new stations, Silver Line, five new stations, we will have a shift more towards Virginia associated with investment that has to be made on there. And so you'll see a little bit more about that when we build the cost picture, because you really need the cost picture to understand what that investment by region will be. But I just wanted a sort of a slight reminder of what that looked like. So when you look at the two key assumptions that we're looking at for revenue, two key drivers. The first one is obviously Silver Line. And the second one is going to be the economic forecast that we look at in terms of what's driving riders and how many. And as you know, that the economic outlook does have a very significant influence in our ridership for our system. So let me just spend a minute talking about Silver Line, and then I'm going to hand it over to Mark, and he can take you through some of the economic outlook. On the Silver Line, what we assumed in FY14 is going to be 6 months of revenue service. And so we have there that here, and you can see the numbers behind me on the chart. Basically, we are assuming on an annualized basis we're going to have about 14.4 million annual riders, and that's the prediction that we're making. I did read something somewhere the other day that 14.3, it used to be 14.3, or it used to be 14.4 and 14.3. But I'll tell you this, it's always been 14 point, four, and as we increased our fares this year, we ran the new ridership numbers through our model. And because of our elasticity, we are assuming that we might lose, 100,000 riders. It's a very insignificant number, but I just wanted to sort of walk you through the 14.4 and 14.3. So as fare impacts, as you know, impacts riders, and we have to accommodate for that. So you see the numbers here. One of the things that we tried to do on the revenue model is assume how much more revenue we will get. You have some riders who are already taking the Fairfax County buses, the connector buses in that area. They may shift over to rail. And if they shift over to the rail, which we're hoping some of them may do because of the overcrowding situation, we will only probably receive another dollar, additional dollar from them because they're already paying, with their trip in another mode. But then we have new riders, and the new riders drive in a lot more revenue. So those revenue riders will be estimated around $3 to $4 a trip. So that's how we build some sort of indicator of how we build the revenue picture based upon the ridership numbers. So I'm going to hand it over to Mark because he's going to talk about just the economic forecast, and then he'll spend a little bit of time talking about the risk. We've already talked about the risks associated with some of these models, and we'll just spend a little bit of time going through some of them. So, Mark.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of you for the opportunity to be here. I know that you've already been briefed previously about the ridership models that we use, and so I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail on them. But the real challenge for us, both on the bus side and the rail side, is to understand both the trend in the ridership and then the seasonality that we have across the course of the year. And what we find on the rail side is that the primary driver for the trend for rail ridership is jobs in D.C. And then the seasonality comes from things like hotel rooms and tourism and things like that. And then on the bus side, we find that the primary driver is D.C. population with a little bit of an impact from things like construction jobs, which also provides a bit of a seasonality impact. So then, once we have those models, then we get quarterly economic projections from Moody's. We take those projections, we use them to update the models that we have. The models look back at the history, try to mimic how the ridership moved and changed in the past, and then use those same model parameters to project going forward. And so Moody's provides us projections for employment and population and construction jobs and inflation and all of those different factors. What you can see from the charts I have here, and they may be a little bit easier to read on paper, actually, is that Moody's is projecting DC jobs to be essentially flat for the rest of FY13, to increase a bit in FY14, and then to really begin to grow strongly in FY15 and 16. And this is not true just for D.C. We also included the Metro Washington picture. They're assuming that's going to happen across the whole D.C. region. And this is a lot more positive than what they had been telling us in previous quarters, this strong and steady growth in 14, 15, and 16. The impact in D.C., for example, would be if jobs continue to be flat through FY13, by the time you get to the end of that period, that unemployment in D.C. would be about 9.5%. And then if you have this strong growth that they're projecting, by the time we get to the end of that period, unemployment would be down to about 7%. That's really very strong and substantial growth. And if you plug those numbers just directly into the model without sort of thinking about it, you get rail ridership and revenue that goes like that out in 15 and 16. And so we knew that we needed to sit back and think about that for a minute. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the risks, and then I'll come back around and talk again about the economic forecasts. So the silver line. Carol talked about the silver line already. We see two sort of general areas of risk with respect to the silver line. The first is, will it open on time? Will the construction be done? Will all the safety and testing be done? We see no reason at the moment to think that that won't be the case, but we're still 15 months away. Something could happen. The other issue, which is a little harder to get a handle on, is how quickly will riders react to the opening of the silver line? If you're taking a connector bus that currently comes into West Falls Church, and the bus now comes into Wheelie, well, you're going to change your behavior pretty quickly. But those folks who have an option, if they live out in Fairfax or Loudoun and now have the option to take the Silver Line in, or even those folks who could potentially do the reverse commute, if you live in Roslyn or downtown D.C. and now can commute out to Tyson's, it's just a question of how quickly are people going to change their behavior and try that new option. So we'll be watching that as the Silver Line comes online. The risk, it's a little harder to put a number to the risk on the ramp up of ridership. It's a little easier on the start date. If we were to be delayed in the opening of the Silver Line by a month, that would cost us about $2 to $3 million in revenue, even though we would be continuing to incur most of the operating costs. So that's the Silver Line. The next issue is weather and events, and this is something that's a little bit hard to get a handle on in a model. It's very easy to look backwards in time and say, oh, that, you know, the Obama inauguration caused this jump up, this Snowmageddon caused this drop down, but it's very hard to predict those things going forward. Our model attempts to account for a lot of the things that we can predict. We have dummy variables in there for various months that we know are high and low. Things that we know that happen every year, like the cherry blossoms, we have that in there. We have assumed certain amounts of hot weather that depresses ridership and very cold weather that also depresses ridership. So we, you know, we put all of those things into the model. What we don't have and what we can't really have is a projection for something like another Snowmageddon type event. If something like that does happen, that ends up costing us, again, something on the order of $2 million a day if weather causes the federal government to close. If we wanted to, we could put something like that into the budget, sort of a rainy day assumption, but at the moment, we don't have that. So then the last risk that I want to talk about is sequestration, and I'm sure that a lot of you are already in your own jurisdictions trying to follow this and understand what the impacts could be. We just wanted to touch on it briefly about what the risks are for Metro. If sequestration does proceed as it's written in the current law, we face risks both directly and indirectly. Directly, we would stand to lose some of our capital funding, particularly the PREA funding. But I think the indirect risk is actually potentially more severe. We are very dependent on government contractors and federal employees who ride our system. And if the sequestration cuts were to proceed, I think we would expect to see a pretty noticeable drop in ridership. It's very hard to sort of get your hands around what the real number associated with that would be. There hasn't been a lot of good information out about how sequestration would actually proceed. The budget cuts, if it goes ahead as planned, are on the order of 10%. Just for comparison's sake, if we were to see a sustained 2% drop in our ridership over the course of a year, that would cost us at least $10 million, perhaps as much as $20 million. That would be a significant chunk from the budget. I can't pretend to put a probability on whether sequestration will happen as it's written in the current law or not. I'll leave that up to the government relations folks who have their ear to the ground on that. But I think you can say that even if sequestration doesn't proceed as it's currently written, I think there still are some risks to the D.C. region. I think there really is, in the political environment, there's a feeling out there that there needs to be cutbacks on both the defense side and the non-defense side. There's a lot of concern about the deficit. Even if sequestration doesn't happen on January the 2nd, I think there are still concerns out there for D.C. employment and thus for our ridership. And that brings me back to the question of the economic forecasts. The access revenue is projected to stay about where it is in the near future. Bus ridership is projected to grow modestly, sort of along with the D.C. population, and so the revenue grows along with that. I think we're comfortable with both of those. I think rail ridership is the real sort of wild card in the picture. As I said, if you just plug those Moody's forecasts directly into the model, in 15 and 16, the ridership really begins to go like that. And we spent a lot of time talking internally about whether that was reasonable and whether that provided us a good base to begin the revenue forecasting picture. And in light of the risks that we see facing, you know, the national economy and then the D.C. region, we felt that that was just a little bit overly optimistic, that trajectory for rail ridership. And as I said, D.C. jobs is the real sort of lever that we have in the model to impact the trend for rail ridership. And if we reduce that trend growth in D.C. jobs so that rather than at the end of the period that unemployment is at 7%, that rather it's at 8%, so still improving, just not improving as sort of quickly, we end up with a much more reasonable, I think, forecast for rail. Growing, but not sort of growing geometrically. And at the moment, that's the assumption that we've decided to use in the revenue forecast. And we think that's more consistent both with the past experience that we've had on the rail system and with the risks that we see going forward. And so with that, I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, so thanks, Mark. So what that says is, and we have the revenue picture there, we're focused on 14, but we're also focused on the 15 and 16. This is where we're starting. As we understand what those risks are and how they play out, obviously this picture is going to change, and you'll see that as we come forward to you in the next couple of months up until January. I will tell you that historically, you know, Mark takes a look at the future, but we also have to look at historically how we have done. And I will say, although in this past year that we just completed in FY12, we were pretty much right on our revenue targets. I mean, I think we were off by $1.5 million, but $800 million base, that's pretty darn good. And so where we faulted was on the mix of that ridership, right? As you saw, you know, we had sort of underrepresented some of the rail. We hadn't expected some of the rail drop, and then we had not. We missed some of the forecast on the bus between the December, or actually it happened in November to April. But the interesting part about that is it really falls in line with the predictive model, right? So when you look at bus, we had great weather. We had great weather all last year. We didn't have any snowmageddons or really, you know, 6 or 8 inches of snow. And so a lot of those factors, new buses that Jack's got on the road, all those factors are not necessarily in your predictive model, but they actually had, you can't anticipate them, but they had an impact to that. So that's what we're struggling with, and that's why you can anticipate what you can, and what you can't, you have to try to figure out, you know, it's an art and it's a science together. So that said, that's kind of where we are now. How does that drive, initially, what does that look like in terms of how we're trying to manage the investments by the local jurisdictions? You know, you've seen the disappearing, we call it the disappearing chart that we had showed, I think, last month. And there's three things that we look at as a backdrop. We look at what our model looks like, and if we look at the revenue picture, we look at the subsidy picture, and then we apply next in line, we'll apply some of the management efficiencies, which you'll see in the next month or two, and then after that you'll see maybe potential fare increases that are in the out years. You'll see that we've taken that cost, that curve, if you will, and try to minimize the investment by the local jurisdictions as much as we can. And so that's the real benefit of the long-range planning that we're doing here, and this is the first time that we're actually looking at the long-range planning and forecasting as it relates to revenue. So this is a work in progress, as you will see. The next steps, we have the next steps there. I won't go through them. I think you're pretty much familiar with how we're going to come back to you, and I guess at this point I'll just open it up to a couple questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kissel, for the presentation. I believe Mr. Downs had a question, then Mr. Downey, then Mr. Bolger.
On the forecast, because this is a public forecast of, in effect, unemployment rates for the District of Columbia in the coming year, while the population forecast continues to be pretty stable, because population in the district has been growing significantly, and it does show some increase in population, but not a proportionate share of growth in transit ridership based on population growth. Because it forecasts almost 10% unemployment in the District of Columbia in the coming year, is there a cooperative relationship between your economic forecasting and the economists at the Department of Employment Services for the District of Columbia?
We have not reached out to them when we do our forecast, but we certainly could.
The reason that's important is I don't want to have a public debate about the forecasted unemployment rates in the District of Columbia that do not include the forecast of the Department of Employment Services, whose full-time job is to make those forecasts.
Yes, no, I totally agree with that. We do not ever want to be inconsistent. The forecast models that we're talking about are really derived specifically from Moody's, and Moody's focuses on this region. So I'm assuming that that entity would also pull from that as well as from other, but we can reach out to them.
But you're also making a staff change to the Moody's forecast. You're projecting a higher rate of unemployment in the district in the forecast than Moody's is.
That is in the out years, that's correct.
And I would ask that you actually coordinate at least from a data and recommendation standpoint,
sure,
the Department of Employment Services.
Can definitely do that.
The other is, when will the formula items, population, population density, ridership, and the change in rail mileage stations, come to the board as an item? Is it November?
You'll see that as a part of the general manager's budget in January. That'll be in there in detail. You'll see pictures of it, I think, probably Mr. Downs in maybe December time frame as we sort of build the expense picture. You'll see pieces of that.
The last is a comment that while a month of delay is quantified as a loss of $2.6 to $2.8 million in revenue, the overall loss is the operating cost per month of the Silver Line versus the revenue, or netted of the revenue. I've not seen anything that would quantify the cost that Metro bears for operating that line without revenue. It's not just the revenue. We're incurring regular operating costs on a daily, weekly, monthly basis for that line. It's the expense line for the Silver Line.
Yes.
As public accountability for finishing this project, the cost of not getting this thing in on time falls almost exclusively on this authority. We're incurring the cost of its operation. The revenues are one side of that equation, but the cost is the other. So I think if, in all fairness to everybody, we need to quantify what the cost of delay is. Totally.
We can do that.
Okay, Mr. Downey, then Mr. Bulger, then Ms. Hines.
Two quick questions and then a conversation about risk. On the formula, when you start including Silver Line stations, will that be for a half year at the beginning?
Actually, we included the five stations in this year's budget. So we already set it up because we have costs associated.
So subsidy to being allocated as if those stations were open.
Just from this five stations.
Not an issue for me, but maybe for others.
well, I think we had, I thought we had that dialogue.
Yeah. And I assume on the, talking about Silver Line ridership, that when we get to the expense budget, that will include the efforts to promote use of the Silver Line?
Yes, it will.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. On risk, the entity, the elements that you've identified are not predictions of what is happening, but estimates of what could be the impact. So we're not saying the Silver Line will be late to open. We're saying if that were to happen, this would be the impact. If there were a Snowmageddon, this would be the impact. There are lots of things out there that could be risks. And we, you know, we need to know what the impact of those are. In the overall budget, we also have a modest contingency. Is that correct?
No.
No.
No, I would like one. Right. That would be great.
That in some settings is the way you deal with a wide variety of risks, and rather than saying this will happen, that will happen.
I totally agree.
If there are risks out there, we might want to look at what the impact would
be. We've never had you call us that.
Okay. The other thing is, particularly on the economic forecasts, you're saying the major impact of perhaps being more an outcome that's greater than we now anticipate is growth in 15 and 16.
Yeah.
We'll have two opportunities to ratchet that up. So either way, it's not a locked-in conclusion that that's where we're going. This thing will be looked at each year, and if things don't materialize badly, then it can be factored in at a later date, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, you know, DC jobs is intended as sort of a proxy for the overall economic conditions, for all those conditions that sort of drive rail ridership. We're not trying to make a specific comment about what we think about DC
employment. And within DC jobs, I think the key variable here is federal employees and federal contractors, and that may well be something beyond all our control. Sequestration or no sequestration, we still may be looking at nothing like prior growth in those categories.
Mr. Bulger, then Ms. Hines, then Ms. Hutchins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since Tyson's Corner is the second largest employment center in the metropolitan area, does Moody's pick that up in these assumptions that we got on page 42 of 57? On page 42 of 57, where you had DC jobs, I know we use DC generally, but is Tyson's in here?
Tyson's gets picked up in the graph at the bottom in the Metro Washington jobs.
Right.
But DC jobs is DC.
All right. Well, let's follow on question. We're going to open five stations in Tyson's, second largest employment, et cetera, et cetera. Do we have any more drill down on jobs at Tyson's and ridership, or is it just all thrown together here on the bottom graph?
At the moment, it's all together in the bottom graph. We could certainly request to Moody's, given the change with Silverline coming, to try to break out Tyson's Corner as its own entity, and then we could try to drop that into the model and see if the model
would you picks do that,
that
and
up.
Let us know what that does to all these projections going forward. So we see what a number of things that can relate to that, which would be ridership and on time and et cetera.
Sure.
Ms. Hines and Ms. Hutchins and then Ms. Bowser.
Thank you. I had the same thought Mort did. You know, we have rainy day, we have snowy day, but we don't have a rainy day, snowy day little pot of money. Let me just ask this question. One of the ways that we've been handling this in Arlington is when we look at our closeout, we've been pulling off a small piece of that, trying to build what we're calling a budget stabilization fund to help us manage through these times. I know we have a different practice here, but I guess I'm sort of suggesting, you know, at $2 million a day, it would perhaps makes some sense for us to begin to think about a strategy over a number of years to create some pot, because things do happen, and I think that might be prudent. And I wouldn't try to do it all in one year, but we could get to something. When I look at the comparison to the previous multi-year forecast, which is on page 46, I really appreciate, again, having the multi-year. It's helpful for our jurisdictions, but the column that's missing here that I would like to have is actual, and I know it was in the presentation at the front end. So you're basically predicting about a 3% increase in revenues.
Yeah, so, and let me break that. We should have had that, I agree. So in FY12, my actual total revenue is 800. Let's take the 13.
I was looking at 13.
So 13, the total revenue is 810 million. We added 64 million, assuming a fare increase, and I think that it's about 874
is what's in the page in the
front. Right. So 874, and so the 3.5% increase, and a lot of that is due to Dulles. Right,
so Silver Line.
Right, the Silver Line. Sorry, Dulles. The Silver Line, and so this half-year revenue is not growth in 3.5% in growth in bus and rail. A lot of that is because now you have an extension that you have 6 months of revenue service. So if you look at that, and then you really look at that, your increase then from year to year is very modest. I don't know what the exact number is.
It's 1 to 2%.
One to two percent.
So I think
that's the picture now.
I think that's really helpful to separate that out as we do service expansion. As you said, you know, there's puts and takes here, and we're pushing different levers. And when we add rail service, the delta of our cost is small because we do so much cost recovery related to the fare. So in terms of the jurisdictional part, it's small. But I do think it's, you know, you're really predicting a 1 to 2% growth in revenues when you factor out expansion of service at this point. Right. So that's, I think, a useful number for us to keep in our minds. Thank you.
Ms. Hutchins? Actually, I think Ms. Bowser had a question, or she wanted to come to the mic, and then Ms. Porter.
Well, my question quickly, it was going back to the point Tom raised a little bit earlier about the unemployment numbers and this projection of 10% in the district. Is that what you projected?
What Moody's had provided us most recently was a projection that DC jobs were going to be relatively flat through the end of FY13, but the DC population was going to continue to grow steadily, so that in effect the unemployment rate in DC was going to trend upwards a little bit. And their projection for the end of FY13, I believe, was 9.5%. And then with that strong growth that they were projecting after that, you would see the unemployment rate move downward fairly steadily.
Okay. So that would seem to be anti-intuitive to what's actually happening.
Okay.
With the unemployment being below 9%. So you're saying that the model says that because more people are moving in, you're projecting that they won't be employed?
Right. That the population growth in D.C. is not keeping up. I'm sorry, that the job growth in D.C. is not keeping up with the population growth.
And this is not our projection.
Right.
This is Moody's projection. We're not.
So you're saying Moody's has the district
over 10% in FY14?
No. I believe, and I can go back and confirm for you, that they have it at 9.5% at the end of FY13.
In the out years?
And then dropping down fairly substantially so that by the end of FY16 it's at about 7%.
They do quarterly forecasts, Ms. Bowser, and we just take pulling that. We're not saying that we believe in it. We're just using that to populate a model, and we're tweaking it. That's
right. Right.
I think we're finding that the people who are moving in are employed.
Are employed.
They are employed. Right. That's why they're moving here.
So right.
If you were telling me that something was changing with the jobs, I could buy it. But if you're saying the population is pushing the number up.
Well, and let me.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, I think I understand.
Let me try to clarify a little bit. Moody's offers us two different projections. One is the total number of jobs in D.C., and one is the unemployment rate in D.C. The number that we use in the model is the total number of jobs in D.C. But the two are obviously linked.
And literally, you're talking about the district, not the region.
That's right. And when we've run these models, we try different variables to see what does the best job. Looking, you know, projecting ridership going backwards. How can we? And we have found that DC jobs is the best proxy for sort of the overall conditions that drive rail ridership.
Thank you.
Ms. Porter, then Mr. Bellamy.
One additional factor that we've talked about in the past is affecting ridership is gas prices, and I don't know if there's any way that can be sort of reflected in the model. I understand there's a couple of problems with that. One being that there isn't really any way to predict what they're going to do. I see people making predictions. Of course, I'm not real keen on the predictions of unemployment either. I don't think we know how to do that, but we do it. But the other problem with the gas prices issue is it seems that gradual changes in gas prices don't seem to affect ridership. It's abrupt changes that do, which adds a whole other layer of complexity on it. So given all that uncertainty, is there any way that we can throw gas prices into the mix in some way that is constructive?
Yes, we do actually have gas prices in the model at the moment, but it is more, it's a gradual factor like you were talking about, that it doesn't include that sort of cliff-like behavior where when gas gets over, say, $4 a gallon, then a lot of people suddenly change their behavior. I think we would like to try a version of the model that has that. We just have not done that yet.
Then Mr. Bellamy?
My question goes back. The last line that we put in was the green line. And in your model, looking at the impact of when the green line came on and the growth, did the model take that into account as a basis?
Well, you know, it did. The model that we have, Mr. Bellamy, is different than the model that we had probably when we had the green line. I can't remember when the green line went in, but we look at each line as well. And we include that in our new model. So, but really, it's not as much of a predictor as it is where people are going or where they're employed. And so they're obviously going to use that line, that new line, because that's where the jobs are. That's where they're going. So that's a better predictor. I don't know if I answered your question, but we do look at new lines. We look at new lines and we look at, is our ridership projection that we had on that line, was that really what we actually, is that actually what we're seeing? I don't know if that's your question, but we do look at that.
The question is the growth. Whenever you put anything in new, maybe bus, or it's going to be slow and taken off. And
then the transition, yes.
Looking at the forecast and then the rail ridership forecast, I guess I was using Green Line because that was the last line that we put in service.
Right.
And how was that trend and historically getting up to the level?
We can go back and look at that. I don't have a great answer for you, but we do accommodate now in our model the transition that you speak about. But it would be good to look at history to see how that happened. Yeah, we could do that.
Are there any other questions for staff regarding this presentation? I would just like to maybe just summarize what we heard today. I think what we've heard is a kind of a sneak peek of our revenue forecast. I think unlike other years, I think we are at a little more risk this year just because of sequestration in terms of external factors that may affect our operating budget. And that's something that I think all of us are cognizant of, but I also think it may have significant consequences in terms of this, in terms of our agency. I also believe we've heard a lot in terms of the model. I would just say that while it is part art and part science, I think the key here is really to understand how conservative or how liberal, no political pun intended, they are being with the assumptions to so we can make sure that we're not going to put in a lot of assumptions that basically we won't make. So I think it's really understanding the assumptions that are key, but also that understanding how, you know, how conservative this estimate is so we are able to forecast properly. So with that, I thank you for the presentation, and we look forward to the subsequent previews over the coming months. I believe Mr. Bolger had a question for the question for the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. As we talked before the meeting, I wondered if we could get on the Finance Committee's agenda a update on Metro Access Fares policy. We talk about it periodically, and then it kind of, in my mind, it kind of falls through the cracks as to what we're doing. If the calculator that we've heard a lot about isn't going to be online, as I understand, until April, and fares for Metro Access still, in my opinion, are confusing to riders, particularly people who depend on Metro Access. Could we get that on our next committee meeting as to, and options about how we could handle the calculator issue? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Maybe what I would suggest is perhaps staff can prepare a memo that they would send out to the board that summarizes kind of where we're at with respect to the fare calculator and also kind of what we're doing in the meantime to help educate the public about the fares structure. And that if there are subsequent questions of the committee after that memo, we will put it on our agenda. Okay, thank you. Any other questions or items to, before the committee? Thank you for staying within time frame. We're actually early today. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.